a world filled with fast-paced living and constant demands on the aging body, it's easy to forget some of the simplest yet most essential elements of our well-being: hydration and nutrients. As you know, when I'm not in the studio recording a podcast or in the gym or out in the scrub hunting, putting rounds down range, I'm somewhere in the world on a security gig, putting in the hard yards, ending up on TikTok. So the legends that get some keep me advancing forward: Jocko Fuel Supplements. More specifically, I've been smashing the Jocko Hydrate Sachets, which helps me replenish my electrolytes and other critical vitamins while boosting energy and supporting recovery. Also, just like my kids, my appetite for veggies goes as far as hot chips from the Colonel. However, every morning I'll mix a scoop of Jocko Greens Jocko Creatine into water, which helps me supplement my lack of and delivers all the nutrients for better gut health, immune support, cognitive function, and physical performance. And not to mention, tastes bloody good. So head over to www.getsome.com.au and use the code ZEROLIMITS all in caps for a discount. I'll leave you with this for the day: hard work, clean fuel, stronger, faster, smarter, better. Let's go.
5-1. It's time for the Zero Limits Podcast, hosted by Australian veterans, chatting with high-charging humans with hectic stories from around the world. We'll give you the motivation to take on whatever life throws at you and the kick to complete any goal you set your mind to. Let's go.
9-3 Bravo, go. Bush Ranger 71 trying to contact you, over. Zero Limits listeners, on today's Zero Limits podcast, I have a special guest from the United States. Now, he spent a total of 16 years in the armed forces. During these 16 years, he spent some of his years within the U.S. Army Ranger side of things. You know, previously I've had a whole bunch of Rangers on, and rather than, I think I heard another podcast and he was about to pull the pin, basically decided to go down the Delta Force, aka CAG or the unit, SMU side of things. And he spent roughly 10 years within the unit as well. Multiple deployments around the world, more specifically Iraq, which we'll definitely talk about. Now, during his time in the unit, Delta, he was also, for the first 2 years, a dog handler. And absolute crazy stories coming up, so stay tuned for this one. But David Nielsen, mate, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Thanks, Matty. Real good to be here. I appreciate what you're doing.
Mate, appreciate you coming on, giving me your time. Now, we've been linked up through a mutual friend, Tom Brown, a canine handler here in Australia. As soon as he passed me your details, I was just like, I was hooked. And then I listened to a podcast with you on it, and it was just, I was hooked. I was driving the car, just absolutely hooked. So I definitely want to share this story with my listeners and get your story out there here in Australia, mate. But before we move on to your military career and your older life, I guess, in current day, let's get back to the younger days. Let's slide back to young David. Where'd you grow up? You know, schooling, etc. And you know, how were you? Were you a hooligan, a rat bag?
Yeah. And you know, I have to say, I so appreciate when I was on with Tom, he did the same thing. He asked about that. That's important. Like, I'm 53 now, and I've come to learn that how it starts is very important. And nobody here in the U.S. would do that, you know, because, you know, they're afraid to open up. And like, I think that's a lot of why we have 22 damn suicides a day. So, yeah, I grew up in Detroit, which is just a nasty city. I mean, that's where we were from, and my dad and mom were split, lived with my dad in the suburbs. And then 45 minutes away, my mom was married to a black man. So I was with her in the city, kind of back and forth, me and my brother. And, it was rough, mostly in the suburbs, 'cause I had, you know, just a stepbrother who just did awful, evil shit to me and my little brother. And I just like, so now is the, I need to say why I do all this, like, why I'm talking about all this because for me, it's a search for the truth, for authenticity, for realism, for why people do what they do and why they are who they are. So that's why I'm here talking about all this. It took me a long time to get to this point, but I think it's important. So the original thing, I appreciate you asking. just a nasty fan. You know, I told Tom, like, this, stepbrother was just, you know, come to find out later in life, he was a real psycho. He just used to piss on me and my little brother. And I would tell my, I'm not crying. I just got seriously like, so I would tell my dad and he would do some a little bit, but it happened again. So weren't protected. You know, and I'm not boohooing. But I'm not going to not tell the truth either. Like, this stuff's important. So, you know, I came to find out that a lot of times our weaknesses are our strengths. That's what enabled me to first time trying out for RIP in the Rangers on a 12-mile road march. And I see, you know, big athletes quitting, tapping out. I'm like, what? Like, I was getting ready to quit on the final 12-miler. And this guy quit. He's like, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm like, there's like 2 miles left. You know, it was physical pain. I'm like, man, this hurts like hell. Skin coming off your feet, but it's nothing compared to what I had been through. So I realized that was a strength right then at, you know, 18.
Just on that, you know, how did you overcome that as, you know, a young male at that age?
I didn't really. I did the best I could. Was just so afraid of everything and everyone, but, you know, trying to become a man. So I became an alcoholic at, you know, the first time I drank at a wedding, 12 years old, my little brother's 9. From there on out, like, this, I remember saying the first time I took a drink, I want to feel like this the rest of my life. So that's how I, you know, coped.
Alcohol.
I couldn't anymore.
At 12.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
So in regard to schooling, you know, what type of support were you getting from school, or how was the school life? Was that similar in nature?
Yeah. So it was in the 70s, 80s. It was just fights. And I was really afraid because, like, all the violence happened at home. You know, I'd go to like the city of Detroit and be walking around, you know, where people were getting killed. And I felt a little bit safer than at my own house in the suburbs. So, you know, just me and my brother got through it. But then again, we didn't, because my little brother hung himself 12 years ago. Who's to say what, you know, what? And, but I know that he didn't get sober and I did. And I know that, you know, a lot of stuff was never worked out. He could never get the stuff out, and I did. So there it is.
Yeah, mate, really appreciate you sharing that. You know, again, you know, as we like to find out where, you know, majority of our guests start their lives, and, you know, obviously you turn your life around completely, become, you know, an Army Ranger and a Delta operator. But, you know, in regards to schooling, did it affect your schooling or your social life in a way? Obviously, you become an alcoholic as well at 12, which is that's just absolutely nuts. And obviously, political correctness does not exist. There is no such thing. So that's a different thing.
Yeah, I maintained like a 3.2, 3.5 GPA through high school. It seemed important to me. And when I look back, I can see like why I became I felt this urge to go to the unit. Like, I know now that I needed to be able to tell any man that he couldn't outman me in the physical department. Not that I'm a badass, just that I can suffer like anybody else. It was like, I know that now. So with school, it was like, I just had this sense that it was important. And it was, because, you know, you needed to be somewhat smart to get into the infantry. People don't know that. They don't want nugs. You got to be able to think, man. Talking on a radio, speaking another language and running an operation, that takes brains. So I something told me that it was important, and I didn't hate it. I didn't love it, but I kept a B plus.
Did you move on to college after?
Man, I got accepted to some schools. I ran track. I was fast, and, you know, Michigan State and a couple others. And I get the letters, and, you know, my sisters had gone on. They were like extremely smart. They got scholarships. So I said, hey, I got accepted. My dad's like, awesome. Congratulations. How are you going to pay for it? I'm like, I don't know. What did my sisters do? Well, they got scholarships, like just, you know, that kind of tough love. So I went and lived in, Detroit with my mom, and you know, that, just 18 years old. And, before long, I was living in my car. I was thrown out, literally, and rightly so, you know, her and her husband threw all my shit out. My buddy comes, you know, he's like, man, my Dominican friend, he's like, all your stuff's out on the road, Rosa Parks Boulevard, 12th Street, Detroit. So, you know, I lived in my Ford Granada for many weeks. And then somebody broke in and stole these little speakers I had. And I was like, that's it. Cause I never once thought of joining the army. I'd watched the movie Platoon. And, I remember thinking, if we ever go to war, I'm like, I need to go in, and I will. And I said that at dinner, and like, people are like, why? And I just literally didn't understand. It wasn't to be cool. It wasn't that I wanted to fight. It was just like, why not? How could you not want to do something about that? So I had this inner urge, to go to war and see, like, the ultimate test. I always have had that. Now I knew why. It's so that now we can talk about real shit and help people get better and live lives, because, you know, it does get better.
Exactly. Just in regards to you wanting to join the military, did you have any prior history in regards to your family history within the
military? Not a one. No.
Nothing?
Not a one. No.
Wow. So obviously you watch Platoon. What's the process? And what year are we talking here?
87,
88. 87, 88. So you've watched Platoon. You've got the urge from the movie. And, you know, it's funny because you say that, because a lot of guys do watch the movies as a young kid playing army in the backyard, and then it translates into what you, like I did, same thing. So what do you do? What's the process? You go to a recruiting station?
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm not living in this Ford Granada anymore. I'm serious when I say this. I did not know that the army paid you. I thought you got food and, you know, somewhere to sleep and that was all I wanted. So I went to the recruiter and, you know, had a couple of parking tickets to get rid of. No worries. And then good grades. So I got to choose, and the Navy wanted me for, you know, even some of their submarine stuff. And, you know, I was able to sell myself a little bit, have a little confidence. And I was just going into some straight leg infantry bullshit. Like, I didn't know anything. I had a couple friends that had gone to the Rangers, and one of them made it and then quit in battalion. But, you know, I couldn't do that at the time. I was like, that it never crossed my mind. Like, I just want to get in, and where can I go? Can I go someplace cool? So I signed up for some whatever unit. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It's just like, you know, I didn't. And so when my day came to go in and process, we had a case of Old Milwaukee Light, and I'm in the back. I went in Cleveland from Detroit, so it was like a 2.5 hour drive, and I'm just hammering them in the back. My friend's driving, and went by. I just remember looking at a state cop, and he pulled us over, and I got a ticket for minor in possession of alcohol. Get to the recruiter in the MEP station. He's like, you knucklehead, I can't believe you did this. Okay, we're going to have to wait a month, whatever, for this to clear. And it sounds like a made up story. I'm leaving, and he goes, hey, you can leave today. Do you want to be an airborne ranger? And I was like, okay. And I don't know what was different about that, but because now normally people have to fight for those contracts. So I left and I went, and from there it was easy. Like, okay, I was in my element then. When they try to bring on the suck, you know, and it's cold and it's raining, and I was just like I said earlier, like, this is nothing. Come on.
So that's how easy it was for you, you know, to pretty much go into that route of the Army Rangers. You were just like, Someone's just offered it to you and he's like, yeah, sweet. Sounds good. Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you hear stuff that sounds like, you know, you can go to jail or go in the army. I'm like, does that really happen? But, you know, and it was just a misdemeanor. It wasn't a huge, it wasn't a DUI. I wasn't driving, but so it's a pretty simple ticket, but I don't know why it happened like that. You know, I believe it was divinely arranged, but, yeah.
Did you have any idea what the Ranger Battalion was?
Or regiment? A little bit. I knew from, yeah, just a little, but, not, no, I mean, just the name. I thought the name was cool. that's it. I mean, at the time there was no, I didn't know a thing. I just thought the name was cool.
No, fair call. So how did you find, the Ranger training?
So then it got a little real after basic airborne, you know, okay, that's, I'm breezing through that. And then in RIP, that's when I was saying that 12 miler, it was, you know, they know how to make it real there. That was what I expected, like for basic training to be like, you know, to get into the Rangers. So, you know, 72 guys in RIP, 12 of us made it. Yeah. Like we're awesome. And, we get to battalion and within 2.5, 3 months, I don't know if you want to get there yet, but
yeah,
we get alerted to go to Panama and, like several of, I don't know how many, but a few of the guys, the 12 that had made it, quit right then. They're like, whoa, it got real. And you know, it's real on a Sunday night. We're getting ready to go home on leave, had plane tickets. You know, we hadn't been home for 10 months. And they came in, you know, Bravo notification, fall out downstairs, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wow, you know, and these guys quit and they weren't going to take me. I had to talk my way on. But I'm still in touch with that guy. Sergeant Rummel's my first team leader. He made the difference in my life and my career. So,
and in regards to Panama, what was happening in Panama? And, you know, and did you even know where it was to start off with?
Basically, you know, I could probably find it, but there was nothing going on at all. However, we had done Grenada, you know, 7 years before that. We knew about that. You know, the Rangers had jumped into Grenada. So we used to sit around, study that, talk about it in our barracks rooms and like, man, you know, and it seemed that what's funny is this is a December 89. We're looking back to October of 83 was Grenada. And it seemed like the distant past. It was only 7 years. Like, so there was kind of a precedent for going in and, you know, invading somebody who had no chance and made a little mistake. You know, I mean, the name of the operation was Just Cause, like, you know, Just Cause. Why'd you go? I don't know. Just Cause. Yeah. I mean, it's the U.S. What do you know, I don't even really give a hoot about all that so much, but we went and man, it's real enough. It was real enough that, you know, we're jumping. And so I'd done some training jumps in the Rangers, which are just brutal. You know, I was on a machine gun team. So, you know, I'm an AB. I'm just a pack mule carrying 600-700 rounds, you know, of 7.62. And the training job, just like there was nothing harder than being a Ranger private. training.
Is it this static line as well?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had like 3 jumps in battalion. No, I had whatever. It was my 13th jump into Panama. So. Yeah, we're, from that night on the 18th or whatever, so we're mission planning and blah, 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 no sleep. Everybody grabs way more stuff than they need. And, we're looking forward to it. Like I wanted to go to war until, you know, stand up, hook up. And it's funny. I just found this thing. They had us make these at the last second. So this is like 34 years old. We put them on top of our helmets. Yeah. I dug it up for reunion last weekend. So we get on. It's a 6-hour flight and it was cold and raining when we were in Savannah. You know, Rangers, we always got to sit outside in the rain, rigged up for some reason. There's like buildings right there. every time, or in the sun, hot sun, you know. So like, you know, December 19th, cold and rainy, and we get on and load 6 hours, you know, on a 141. And we get there and it's 1:05 in the morning. And, you know, they're like, they know we're coming. We heard, I think. And the pilots turned on the intercom and, I'm on the first bird, man. There's 14 chocks, maybe. Me and my gun team are on the first, you know, each side, starting Rummels, my man. So I'm an E2 private, like just stand up, you know, hook up, and they're going down and they open the doors and we had been cold for 6 hours and it was like this tropical air came in. It's like, oh, it felt so good. And then you hear pop, 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 pop. They're hitting the plane already. You see tracer rounds and you hear some of them hitting the plane. And, you know, I was the ninth guy out of the left door. So like I caught a glimpse. I remember I could see grass. We were so low. It was like, you know, could we jump from 800 feet, 1200, 800 on this? It was, you know, coming in at 500. They even went lower for the guys behind me. I could see grass. I'm like, what the? Oh my God. So go and, but you know, before that I remember thinking when I heard the rounds, like, I should be scared. I should be thinking about things they think about in movies when this happens. I'm like, my family. I could not picture my family's faces. I couldn't think of their names. I was blacking out. And then my team leader Rummels, he's like, you ready to get some team? He just like screamed. I could hear him over the damn jet engines. And it got me out of it. And I was like, all right, here we go, you know, and out we go. 100 pounds of lightweight shit. You know, I probably fell out and coming down there was a line of tracers right below me, orange tracers. And then I was like, oh boy, I hit like crap, landed. And then they shot above me. So I kind of landed through them and, you know, many, many guys got wounded on that, 5 killed. So from there, I wasn't involved in any action. It was just, you know, like making my way into the objective that we had rehearsed so many times. But that's the first time I experienced the slowdown, the time lapse, which was so interesting because I'm like, move. I'm telling myself to move. And then I look over and I see my buddy and like, we're running at the same speed, doing the same things we should be doing. So I didn't know it at the time, but you know, my brain is processing faster than it ever has.
How long were you guys in Panama for?
Like 2 weeks. So, you know, after that, we secure the airfield. There's a couple gunfights here and there, nothing much, you know, but enough. Anytime somebody gets killed, it's enough. And, you know, so that I remember 5 in the morning, then they send the 82nd and they jump in like as the sun's coming up. And then another unit came in and they jumped in and it's like everything was done. So after that, we went out in the mountains looking for Noriega and, you know, just, something cool in Panama, man. It was the worst rucking I've ever done to this day. Just the hardest. I was on this mountain. You can look and see both oceans, man. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you do your 2 weeks in country, then you get back to the United States, man. How are you feeling? Because that was, you know, this is your first, that's your first operation, first time in, you know, somewhat of a war zone. How'd you go? How'd you feel?
It's interesting because I wanted to go to war because I wanted to either die or change. And I didn't know how. So I was just like, you know, I'm pretty good at finding something to, like a hornet's nest to stir up. So, life just sucked. I mean, I'm a raging alcoholic at, you know, by that point. And all I do is drink. And, but so when I came home, it was like, I changed. I wasn't afraid. And I went out and I met my wife. Like I went up to this one and said, hey, how you doing? And got to know her and did what normal people do because I had faced a fear and something in me changed. So I got a little bit of life at that point. So I want more of that, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Now, mate, moving forward, obviously the following year, 2nd of August, 1990, someone that you know, I guess you get to meet down the track, Saddam Hussein, started the invasion, launched an invasion of Kuwait, which leads on to Desert Storm, mate. What was the talks happening here throughout the regiment?
That was, I had just finished Ranger school, so I'm, you know, I got some rank, I'm an E4, and I'm, again, when that stirred up, I wanted to go to war. Sometimes I want to go to war now. It's weird. I don't, but there's nothing like it. There's just not.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's so like, I want to sometimes explain just what 5 minutes, 5 seconds is like. It's beautiful. It's horrible. It's so many things, but Desert Storm was, I just got married and just got back from Ranger school, and they chose my company out of 12 Ranger companies to go. So I'm like, I wanted to fight, but I didn't want to deploy, but we did. We didn't do anything, man. You know, the unit was there. They did a couple things. And, we were talking earlier. That's when I first saw the Aussies. They were out like doing what we thought we should be doing. We're in there, you know, at RR Airfield in Saudi, marching to Chowlut, you know, like one guy marching two other guys in the Rangers. I'm like,
yeah.
And then, these guys roll in and just everybody stops and they're watching. And it's, you know, the Aussies coming in from being out in the bush in their vehicles, you know, for weeks and weeks. And they go to Chow and they had somehow a freaking pallet or a bunch of Bacardi shipped over there, you know? So we're just like in awe, and we see him in the chow hall and like kind of young Ranger and dudes with beards. You're like, good day, China. How's your war going, mate? And we're like, not really good, to be honest, sir. We're not doing much of anything. How's yours? And they're like, good. 6 weeks of killing Iraqis. Oh, that's cool. Like, I want to be like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously this is the SASR.
Yeah. I'm just learning.
Yeah.
The different. Yeah.
So, you know, that in a way, that's the equivalent of, you know, the Delta side of things for us here in Australia, which I'm sure you work
for all my military, for all my like experience and achievements. I am like criminally dumb on a lot of stuff. Guns, like people are like, you have a lot of guns. I'm like, nope. I mean, a few, you know, a few special ones, but
yeah. So how long did you spend in Desert Storm?
That was like 3 months. And you know, just nothing for us. Came back and I got out of the army. I never planned to stay in. I did a 3-year hitch and got out and 21, 22 and like, really drinking hard, immediately ran my marriage into the ground and was my first divorce. So I'm up in Northern Virginia, DC area, just, going to school at George Mason, as an English major. Like I like to write and I could never decide what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I just had this job, at a tech company, you know, doing facilities. So I got to travel a lot and move around. So. Did that for a lot of years, and I would always be, I remember sitting in my office, you know, hungover or getting ready to go drink and just like, man, thinking of the Delta guys, you know, in Panama and in Desert Storm and just how cool it was. And, you know, cause one of my friends stayed in and made it in, and like I lost contact with him, and, you know, so I was just always wondering. And then it like, 30 years old, I'm thinking I'm too old. I just, you know, I didn't know a thing. So if you want me to keep going along the timeline.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
In 1999 or 2000, I had a back surgery for fusion from that Panama jump. And the chief of staff of the Army, General Shinseki, decided to give everybody the Black Beret. I'm a civilian. And at that point, there was like just chat rooms and stuff, the internet. Like, so I was in touch with some old Ranger guys, and somebody started this. They're like, we're going to march from Fort Benning to DC to protest this Black Beret thing. So I was like, I'll help. I'll tag along. We did. We're on the news. I was a civilian. So, you know, we're walking, you know, 25 miles a day, 30 days, and, did that, got some traction. You know, we were able to get tambourines instead of black. All that to say that, testified in Congress against this 4-star general. So that was kind of cool, standing up to a guy, you know, E5 Buck Sergeant Nielsen. But, after that, it was like, I woke up one morning, it was like, I'm going back in the Army. It was in me that I needed to go back. And I'm on my second marriage now, my daughter's mom. And she screams, she's like, no. But it was just like, I'm sorry, I got to go back in. Like, I know I do. And so I started the process. And that was before 9/11. 9/11 happened. And then it took me a year to get back in because of my back surgery and, oh God, my age. I don't know. I had all these strikes against me. So it took forever to get back in. And, they kept telling me no. And then they're like, you can be a cook or a mechanic. Those are your two choices, your two options. And I said, oh, well, I want to be a Ranger again. And, so I finally brought in the newspaper. I was on the front page of the Washington Times with the Black Beret thing. And I just took a chance. I didn't know if it was going to piss them off or make them happy. I said, this is me. I just walked 700 miles because I love my country and I want to be a Ranger again. And it was this woman, E8, at the MEP station. And she was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Hang on, stay here. That day, I had orders straight back in after a 10-year break. Didn't have to go back through basic. Usually the rule is 3 years. Right back to first Ranger bat.
Just in like that.
Yeah. So that's all it was. They're just holding you up, you know?
Yeah. Wow. So you said you started that process prior to 9/11. Yep. Were you a civilian or were you back in the Rangers when 9/11 happened?
No, I was still a civilian and it was so hard to watch all that.
Yeah. So let's talk about that because obviously this is a defining moment. Obviously moving forward, it changes the course of history for any military around the world pretty much. And mate, run us through this day.
I'm sleeping because I had a night job because I couldn't have like a real job. And I kept having to go to the MEP station every 2 weeks for the Army to just jack me around for that year. So I had some crappy night job. So I'm sleeping and my wife wakes me up and tells me that, you know, what happened. It was like, cool. Do you understand why I say cool? Because it's like, now we can go fight. Now we got a reason, you know, not cool that people died, of course, but we know, you know, that if they get the chance, they're going to do that. Like, why do we have to explain that? I don't know, but some people don't know. So it was like, all right, right on. Now we're going to be able to go and actually fight as opposed to Desert Storm where we did nothing. So not that, you know, don't get me wrong. It's not like war, but if we're going to go, right? If whoever's in charge decides that we're going to go, shut the fuck up, leave the phone alone. You know, at that point, let us do our jobs. So that's where I'm coming from. I know I do the Christology podcast and I sometimes have a mouth. That's where I'm at in my life. I'm working out my own salvation with fear and trembling. So I'm just being real where I'm at. Yeah. So it happened and I was back in by January. So, 2.5-3 months of waiting.
Yep. So you're back in after 9/11, back into Rangers. You know, nothing's really happening for that first, obviously the CIA head into Afghanistan, SEALs and stuff head in as well. I think October, November, December, and then subsequently the rest of the world kind of follows lead. What happens? What's the talk going around the Ranger Regiment for you guys? Are you talking about going to Afghanistan? And then obviously March 2003, Iraq kicks off.
Yeah, the Rangers actually 3rd Battalion, not my battalion.
Yep.
They did a jump into, I forget where, but somewhere in that October area. And then 175 was Roberts Ridge when those, you know, 3 guys in ACO were killed. So I got there right after that when ACO lost those 3 guys at Roberts Ridge. And it was like Afghanistan. I just want to go. I was just, you know, chomping at the bit. 33 years old. But God, the Rangers sucked, man. Really sucked. It might have been because I was older. Maybe because I've been to Delta and I know the difference. But, you know, it's just things like you don't get paid to think. Hearing that over and over and over. Like, I can only take so much of that. Or, hey, are those socks you're wearing? Are those Army issue socks? Well, no. First Sergeant, they're smart. Well, you got to take them off, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know. I'm not built for that. So they say Delta is the place for people who hate the Army. And I found it, man. 3 more years in the Rangers. So from 02 to 01 to 04. I had a good leader who let me train up for selection, let me go to selection. And I was either going to make selection or get back out. So I went to selection. Absolutely loved it, man. You know, I'd heard about it for years, the mystique of the mountains. And I just like being alone, you know. Snowy mountains, find your way. I love that.
Yeah.
So I smoked that. You know.
Sorry, just quickly, before we touch on your selection side of things for Delta, mate, back to 2003, as I spoke about earlier, Saddam Hussein. Now, there's an interaction. You obviously hanging out with Saddam in a way, chatting with him.
Yeah, and I want to make clear that I was not on that, you know, I wasn't there when they pulled him out of the hole.
Yeah.
My buddies were that. I was the most fringe part of the operation. You could be like combat search and rescue, I think. I was on a piece of crap 57 that caught on fire, you know, and we had to land. However, after, you know, the mission was done, they brought him back. For whatever reason, they had us guarding him in the, whatever the hell it's called, man, in his little detention center. And I'm on one night, you know, and I look in that room with those black and white tiles. And it's like, man, he's right there. And I had my little disposable camera, you know, I was supposed to take pictures, and I got a picture of him. I'm like, hey. Psst. And then he's like, I have to go to the bathroom. You know, he spoke really good English. So I, all right, come on. You know, the Ranger buddy with me. And we just walked him down the hallway, and he just looked over at me, and he's like, how you doing? I said, oh, all right. How are you doing? Surreal. Not bad. He said, do you like cigars? I said, oh, yeah. I had some in Belize that were incredible. And he's like, yeah. And he starts talking to me about cigars. And I'm like, I feel like my buddy looking at me. I'm like, should I be bullshitting with Saddam Hussein? I don't know. But I, you know, probably not. So he took his piss and I took him back, and that was it. But I love, man, funny stuff like that. I live for those moments that are just like, what? I mean, just ridiculous.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Yeah. And so was he, what did he look like? Was this post, you know, he just looked like a homeless dude?
Yeah. He didn't look like this. This is a clock I still have of him. He did not look like that anymore. Yeah.
Have you got that photo still?
I don't have it in my possession, but I know where it is. Rhymes with ex strife. It's with my ex-wife somewhere.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. So, mate, moving forward again, back to the Delta. So actually, quickly, in regard to the Delta thing, you obviously seen them in Panama and Desert Storm cruising around the Little Birds, thinking, you know, these guys in their, you know, Oakleys on their heads, looking cool.
Yeah, and all the Rangers, oh, we could do that. I'm like, no, we can't, because we're not. But yeah, and then I really saw them closer when we went to Iraq in 03. So I did one rotation in Afghanistan. And then almost immediately we went to Iraq, and I did two with the Rangers in Iraq, you know, 3 monthers. And, so we're doing the perimeter, and they're going in and doing real hits. And I'm kind of still fresh off the street. Like, so I had that 10-year break in service. You know, we go to jump when I come back in and I'm putting my hands on the door. They're like, whoa, what are you doing, Geronimo? We don't do that anymore. You know, like, I was just doing old stuff. And, because I didn't have to go back through basic training. So there's a real sharp learning curve. And, I was a sniper team leader. So we're on it. We're in a blocking position, and I hear this pop, 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 pop. And I'm like, you know, it gets done. And I'm like, nobody said anything. I'm like, who got shot? There was a gunfight. They're like, no, dumbass, that's a nine banger. I'm like, what's a nine banger? Like, it's a flashbang that goes nine times. Like, I just didn't know so much, but obviously I kind of, you know, caught up, but it had changed so much. It used to be like, don't talk to the, you know, all the stupid nickname guys. You know, but in Desert Storm, there was a dude in the unit who played bagpipes, man. That was so cool. I used to get up. He'd be up early in the morning, and I would get up to go watch him play his pipes, man, in Desert Storm. But you could just tell that, like, they got to think. And nowhere in life, I mean, there's a place to smush people down and hold them down, basic training, okay. But I don't know, man. Just, it was, you know, get out or get out of the Rangers. So we did the Jessica Lynch thing, you know, we dug up 9 bodies. Like, I wrote a piece on that because yes, it was a silly little hostage rescue. We knew where she was. There was no fight, but we had to dig up 9 American bodies. They never talked about that in the media. It drives me nuts, man. I just watched the Pat Tillman documentary, and he's like, you know, he was in second bat, so he's somewhere else. The mission's done. It says this in the movie. I'm like, he didn't know what we were doing. I wish somebody would have, because they don't disseminate information in the Rangers. And he hears an A-10 doing something like somewhere else. So he thinks we're just there doing this Jessica Lynch thing to drop bombs somewhere else. He didn't know that we were digging up these bodies in graves that had been in there for 3 weeks. In the desert, right? Our people with fucking e-tools and hands. And it took a long time. E-tools were breaking. Guys were throwing up. I'm on a roof right next to it. You know, the smell is indescribable. It's worse than death. There's a death smell. There's a rotten smell. And then there's this. So we recovered all 9 people, what we could of them. You know, we had this idiot commander who had us in MOP 4 for 3 days before the mission. And he's walking around in Ranger panties and t-shirt. You know, I just cannot stand the hypocrisy of some people. Anyways, he's coming over the radio. Come on. What's taking so long, sir? We're digging up bodies. Like, dude, you know. And you hear people like, I found an arm, I found a head, putting him in body bags, you know? So that's important. That is really important. I would find out when I lost my dog Pepper, which we'll get to, and we never recovered her body, right? I'd do freaking anything to be able to have recovered her body. I had dreams for years of her running back and forth looking for me to come in on the little bird to get her. But I trusted that it was important. You know, and that's why we did that. And so we've been up for 3 days. We get these, you know, so we leave at sun up, and the mortar truck with all the body bags goes off the road, and they fall off the freaking, you know, this is life as a Ranger private. So we got to repick them up. You know, when we finally get back, and people are just sick, took our clothes, burned them. And then just nothing. Like the press never said anything about it. And then I see that Tillman documentary and the 2nd Ranger Battalion, he didn't even know what we were doing. So, man, my policy now is why I'm the other reason I'm doing all this is to just not cover anything up anywhere, anytime, including myself. Right. So
just on that, sorry, mate, like, can you expand on who these 9 service personnel were?
Yeah, I don't have their names, but when Jessica Lynch was, when her unit was ambushed and all that happened in March, was it March of, whatever, it was in springtime. There were 9 people killed either in that incident or an IED, a combination of 2 things. I don't know all the details. I have it in my journal, but, when she was in the hospital in Nazaria, where we went, we thought it was going to be a fight. We thought we were going to have to do a hostage rescue, but we didn't. Right. So, you know, everybody blew it out of proportion that, you know, the Army made it this big thing. They did. They thought it was going to be a big thing. It wasn't. So, but I never heard anybody talk about those bodies. And I don't know their names. I could find them. You know, but we brought their remains home for their family. And like that. Yeah, I wrote something about it called Sniper Dialogue, where me and my buddy were talking about it. And, you know, finally Sergeant Fader, he's a dude, you know, he's the one like running the guys digging and stuff. He's finally like, hey, sir, either shut the fuck up or, you know, come over here and help dig. There's eyes coming out of heads, sir, you know. So that's leadership.
Yeah, right. Bloody hell. Yeah. Again, mate, moving forward back to selection for the unit, mate, how did you find that? And, you know, what was the process to get onto this, selection? And obviously you had the drive to, join the unit. Did you know much about it outside of what you've seen?
Not very much, a little more. The movie Black Hawk Down had been out. Somalia happened right after I got out. So I saw that. And it's like, okay, that's what I thought. You know, that was the first real kind of open thing where you could see what they really do, the type of CQB, the amount of training they have to be able to do that. So it was like, yeah, I'm going to give this a shot. I really had no idea. I knew that I had it in, like, it's cliche, but I knew nobody could break me, not even close, you know. Coming at me and all that stuff. Like that just makes me laugh when you try to make it harder. Like that's the easy part. So selection was easy. I did, however, struggle in OTC. I failed, man. Like my pistol shooting was horrible. I'd never shot a gun before I came in the Army. So, you know, I learned as I went in the Rangers, I was okay with rifle, but I just never even shot a pistol. And made it all the way through to the end in my first OTC, you know, which is operator training course after you make selection to get into the unit. And I failed, but that's why I became a dog handler. That's how, that was my plan. If I should fail, cause a lot of people do fail. And I asked for that and I got it.
Yeah. Right. So what happens? So you fail the pistol component and then they offer you a support role.
Yeah. And they, you know, they said your peer reports are good. That was the main thing. Your peers are good. So do you want to be a heavy breacher? Like nobody had done this yet. And when I was a Ranger, I remember watching the unit and they had this badass dog named Rudy. And I'm like, oh, there's nothing cooler than that. I want to do that. Or, you know, if I get the opportunity, I want to do that. It had just begun as a program. It was only a few years old. So I failed. I get called in, you know, we were the last cut in a couple buddies and they said, would you like to be a breacher? I said, thank you for that, Sergeant Major, but is there any chance I could be a dog handler? And he said, hold on. He went and talked to somebody. He came back. You're going to C squadron, you know, you're going to do it. Yep. You got it. So I was like, whoa.
Yeah. So it's just, it was that easy to obviously start the dog side of things. Is there a second chance for you to finish that pistol component to pass again, or was it you just going to do the dog handling?
Absolutely, there was. And that, you know, that was the stipulation, was you can come back in 2 years, and not everybody gets to do this.
Yep.
So you can go back in 2 years. You can either go back to your unit, no way, or, you know, you can work here in the building, support this or that. So that I asked for that. And, I was surprised as, you know, could be, but, so it was kind of like the worst day and the best day driving home that day. I was like, you know, screaming because I failed. Like, I don't fail stuff. But I did, but I knew that, you know, that bright light of being a dog handler was there. So, and I did go back in 2 years and smoked it, drafted at the top,
which we'll talk about shortly. So you start this dog side of things and the training side of things. How'd you find the training to become a handler?
Really cool. I liked it. You know, they had some former unit guys who were retired and who had done it. So they spoke the language, you know, and I loved it. And so it was weird in the building because I had been through West Virginia, but I wasn't an operator yet. So I had some respect, but I was still support. And I knew that. I was fine with that. It just helped me to get along. Because they did experiments. They brought in some other MOSs to be handlers, and it wasn't so good. You know, they're thinking, well, you can train. We'll bring in some dog handlers from wherever and teach them infantry. Like, it didn't work. So I just had to learn the dog part, and it, you know, I've always loved dogs, and the way I got Pepper was so, you know, as I talk about my story, I'm like, man, I've had some cool stuff happen, on accident, but you know, I was going to get this other, I can't remember his name, but so I get my new team leader and we go through the kennels and I'm seeing the dogs and they're like, oh, we have one female, her name's Pepper. You know, look at her. She looks like somebody's pet. And I looked in and she's just sitting there. All the other dogs are going nuts. And she's sitting down, wagging her tail, looking at me, a little Malinois. But I was like, man, I mean, call me, you know, whatever. I don't care. But I was like, I didn't say it, but I'm like, I want that dog. She was another guy's dog. Really good dude. So he got a DUI like that weekend. He had to leave the unit for a year. That's how I got Pepper. They were going to bring in some other, you know, another dog. So I got Pepper and we just, you know, instantly hit it off. And I would just make it a point. I would stay after work and take her out to the green hill. We just had this space, man, with this grass. And, you know, after all the work and the biting and the tracking and all the hard training, I would just take her out and spend time with her. I wanted to have, you know, you hear about that special bond that takes a long time. We had it. We really did. And I believe a lot of it was because, you know, I did that with her. So, you know, I really believed in our relationship.
What breed was she?
She was a Belgian Mal. Just 53 pounds of fury when on target, but she was like the only dog that you could just let her out and hang out with the dudes. People loved her, man. And like, you do this thing, you tap your chest and she'd jump up this high and land like on your shoulder. So it was almost too much. Like everybody, hey, where's Pepper? Like, you know, feeding her and stuff. So I was pretty protective of her. When my daughter was born in 05, I came home. I got to come home for that for, you know, 2 weeks. I took Pepper with me. They were trying to get me to leave her so they could maybe use her as a float dog. I'm like, no way. Took her home. I flew her civilian air. I talked her way on to a commercial flight from Germany to Chicago. She's sitting right there in the cabin with me. This guy comes and sits down and she stared at him up for 9 hours. She's just staring at this guy and he's like, what do I do? And I'm like, I don't know, man. This is our first time doing this. But yeah, she was just awesome. So we did, I think, two rotations. No, one. Everything was cool. And then it was 06. Oh, we did one and then a surge. And then another full rotation. So if you want to go there now.
Let's touch on that first rotation though. So obviously just quickly, you and Pepper, she was a green dog before she started, and obviously you've trained her up together. You form that bond, and then you get your first appointment back to Iraq, 06. Yep.
She was very green, and in fact, she had been semi-fired from the unit. A lot of dogs don't make it, and a guy had her, good friend of mine, Kelly Roby.
I know Kelly, yeah.
Yeah, he had her first for a while. He was in another squadron.
Yeah, right.
Yep. And she bit him right in the balls during a mission. So, you know, she went out, came back, and it was dark, and bit and quickly realized the mistake. But for whatever reason, it didn't work. And she was not doing well. So then I had her. I'm green. She's green. We go over there. I've got that sort of wavering self-confidence from not making, failing OTC. And I'm starting to hear guys kind of chirp in the background because she didn't have any bites for the longest time, man. It seemed like the longest time. Other dogs are getting bites and getting blown up and purple hearts. And like, we just didn't have any action for, it seemed like a long time. If I look at my journals, it was probably like 4 or 5 weeks, but finally the first bite came in. I mean, people were saying, I heard this team leader say, she's not going to bite. What's the point? Why are we wasting space on a bird? You know, and I was really nervous about it. And her first bite was, you know, we're bringing these detainees back and everybody would muzzle their dog with detainees. I didn't have to because she didn't bite. Well, this dude, for some reason, like pushes back at me and we're in an exchange place. Like he's trained. He was trained on what to do if you're captured.
Yeah.
Escape as quickly as possible. He starts resisting me. The blades are spinning. You can't hear anybody. He finally like turns to whatever he's going to do. I don't know. Attack me. And she bit him in the dick, just like Kelly Roby. And this dude screamed. And I'm thinking, oh no, I'm in trouble. But like, I look around and they're like, yeah, everybody's cheering because she got her first bite. And I'm like, yeah, you know, cool. And then from there on, it was smooth sailing. We got a lot more bites. And Maddie, the coolest thing about her was like, dudes would die. Man, that road, we took 50%, you know, wounded and killed in that first one. But so people would die, you know, and you know, the mood around we're staying in one of the houses, Uday and Kusei's houses on the river. You know, it's like the next day you lose a guy. It's just like, there's nothing to say. But, you know, I would let Pepper go and you would hear like just silence to just people talking normally. And then the next room. And then before you know it, Pepper, and then people are up and it's not back to normal, but it's like, I don't know, man. She did what only a dog can do and just changed things. So, and she could do that even, after she had bites and stuff. She was so special like that. So people really got attached to her, her uncles, I call them. So
when you talk about 50% casualty rate for your unit, for the team that was there, that's massive. How did you guys cope with that?
It was almost like, I don't know if you experienced it, but we knew these wars were kind of not World War II for lack, I don't know how else to say it. Right. And we're always comparing ourselves to that. And that would piss me off because like, we don't have a choice, man. And I had a Vietnam Ranger friend who helped me through a lot of stuff. And, you know, there are several of them. They're like, you don't choose your wars, you know, just fight them. So, you know, I tell guys that. And, so when we had that, it was kind of like some sort of pride, I think. I mean, we had a whiteboard with names and, you know, most of them are wounded, but we had 3 killed and it's terrible. But like, man, I just like to say things that I think are going on. I don't know if they are or not, but I think guys were like, okay, this justifies a little bit us being away from our families and, you know, this war that people are protesting. So you don't want deaths, but you want a legitimate war or you feel cheated. You know, I do.
Basically, you guys just go back out and kick some more ass, really, as well.
At that time, we're trying to find Zarqawi. And this, nobody really remembers him, but he was the one sawing off heads and playing it on the radio. Yeah. So that, I mean, that was the real deal. And not my guy, you know, but my peers, the room over, would get him eventually. But we were looking for him at the time. And Saddam's gone. You know, SEALs are looking for bin Laden in Afghanistan. And, we just, Zarqawi was that, you know, that was everything. And, we did get one of his guys and Pepper. Oh, she bit him so nice, just in the like back. Cause he turned to laugh and, you know, he moved right into her and she just, it was, yeah. He didn't like that. He said, "Mister, the dog make pain." I'm like, "Yeah, she does." So that was one of the guys that was with him in that video. The five idiots wearing the mask. I have one of them. You know, the black ski mask with the Allah Akbar bullshit.
Yeah.
I keep that in a box for I don't know what, my boys, I guess.
Yeah. When you talk about Pepper, you're a bit nervous about her not biting at the start, but obviously she got the taste from Kelly. And then obviously that second Iraqi. And then from there, that's where the switch has flicked and she's turned into just a little firm missile.
Oh my gosh. Yes. You know, and sometimes after, so now she's that, and we had some dry holes and, you know, 8-10 hours of work to the point where she's like snapping at me and I'm like, "Oh no, we're not playing that." You know, we had a little fight and I tied it best, like, you know, cause you can't let your dog rule you, but she showed me pretty much like I had a shiner, man, from just wrestling with her, you know, just like who's in charge here. So it was almost like she showed me I could mess you up if I wanted to, but I'm not gonna, but chill out on the corrections, you know, so awesome dog.
How long was that first rotation?
So it was 3 months, and then the surge was 3 weeks, and then the second one where she died was 3 months, and it was toward the end of that one.
Yeah, so let's move on to that second rotation, mate, after the surge. You're back into country again. What is the role this time? Same, similar, just attached to the unit and doing missions, direct actions?
Well, I'm in the unit. I'm in a squadron. Like, I'm rolling with the real guys. So, yeah, we're just going out. We were in Baghdad. So there was something every night, two or three things every night. And so it's flowing and I'm a pretty good handler at this point. You know, it remains probably the hardest job I've ever done. Getting on and off a Blackhawk with a dog on that tether, you know, maybe they fixed it now, but it was like one of us is going to face plant. just, you know, the simplest things are difficult with a dog attached to your left hip. But it went really, really well. And on the mission, it was this massive, several units together, you know, effort to get Zarqawi. So, and the night before, Lance Cornett had been killed. And this dude, we went through selection, OTC. Lance was a dude and he loved dogs. That's the thing, man. It makes it weird. In selection, there was this dog that followed us when we were in, you know, the part where you do it with everybody together. And he and I were just always talking about this dog. So he loved dogs and, he got killed the night before Pepper did. So, you know, I'm like mad. I go up to the gym, or the, you know, with the heavy bag over there. And, at this point I'm sober. I don't drink anymore. I got sober and, 2009 finally, but this was before that, but I was sober there. So everybody else is drinking, you know, doing whatever. I'm up in the gym with Pepper, kicking the bag, and she's just there with me. Like, it's almost like she was with me, like I was with her on the Green Hill in training. You know, I try not to go too far with anthropomorphizing, whatever, but, she knew something was wrong. You know, I'm not saying she knew somebody died, but she knew my mood and it was bad. So again, that next day, you know, I let her go around the house and I hear, "Hey, Pepper." So super special. So the next night we go out, it's about as simple as it gets as a canine team. We're on a little bird, you know, I didn't even have to kennel her on a little bird. So it's just her behind me and 5 minute flight, Baghdad, just South Baghdad. But nasty, nasty area. Flying in, we could see parts of Humvees where they had blown up American vehicles with IEDs. Super nasty spot. So this massive mission with all these other units, we're hitting the main target building. I'm just squirter control. So we didn't even land. We're just orbiting in case there's a squirter. There wasn't. The hit goes down, blah, 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 you know, okay, we go home. It was 30 minutes. And as we're walking back, the pilot, wait, we got a squirter. So, okay. So we get back on, we go right back. That's how that happened. It all kicked off pretty early at night, you know, 9, 10 a.m. darkness, February, maybe it was earlier. I don't know. But so we go back and, you know, I'm seeing it on this, you know, somebody's showing me as we're flying, you know, what it looks like, where he went. So we get there and, I'm fine talking about it now because I talked about it so much. And in the movie War Dog, A Soldier's Best Friend, a documentary that HBO produced. And, you know, sort of a side story. I went to the VA like before all this because I needed help. And I chose to talk about Lance Cornett and the Pepper story. So that therapy that I got, that help that I got from the VA actually really helped me to be prepared to talk about it in the movie. So, you know, so most people, well, know the story, but there's a squirter. I'm hoping it's Zarqawi. This dude had it set up, you know, a spider hole and on the banks of the Tigris River, which were muddy. It was raining. It was cold February. And even in the desert, I didn't know this till I saw it. There is the thickest. Yeah, there's palm groves, but on the banks of the rivers, there is like farm field, muddy fields that have been there thousands of years. I mean, it's where Abraham started. It's where it all civilization started, right? So it's just so archaic and old, and the lumps in the ground is just, you know, been farmed for thousands of years, and it's thicker than the Panama jungle, or as thick. Impossible to get through without getting shot as the dude's in a hole. Perfect scenario for a dog. So we send Pepper the first time and nothing. And then I hear a muffled pop, like a 9mm muffled. I'm like, oh shit, she got shot. And so like, what do we do? We're trying to, okay, now we have to, and just before all this, we had shot every type of munition, rocket, grenade that we had into this thing. And the eye in the sky could still see the heat signature. So like we weren't even phasing him. Couldn't drop a bomb because there's houses all around with kids in them. So that was the reason we didn't just, you know, smoke it and leave. So we're getting ready to make an alternate plan. And Pepper comes back walking real slow, like, so I'm like, okay, come here. But I get her and I'm just looking for the bullet hole. Cause you know, her behavior was totally like she's bleeding out. I'm training this. My wife, actually Laura Miller, she's a vet tech at the unit, first vet tech there. She trained me we were friends at the time, you know, we're married now afterwards, but, she trained me in, you know, pretty much emergency medicine for canines. So I'm checking her and there's nothing. I got her vest off, everything. I'm behind a little building. And at this point, this is all that's going on with the whole mission. Everybody else had secured their targets. We just got to get this squirter. So there's like hundreds of people waiting. You know, we've all been there where you're like, what the heck's going on? You don't know what's going on. It was this. We're trying to get this squirter. So, no bullet hole. And then all of a sudden she peps up and she's fine and she's wet. And I'm like, oh, this dude put her underwater and tried to drown her. So, okay. Cause she didn't like water. So I'm like, that's what happened. And she was probably partially, you know, unconscious and barely made it out somehow. So good girl. So man, no longer do I get her vest back on. And I'm like, and I knew it was like, nobody had to say it. It was the eeriest thing. I'm like, I'm the only dog here. We can't get this dude out. I'm going to have to decide to send her or not. Now I know I'm going back to OTC right after this rotation, right? So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm going to the range every day and my pistol shooting is on. So I know I'm going to be an operator soon. And, you know, maybe Pepper will retire with me, maybe not, but, but I love this dog. And, you know, the commander came on. He's like, well, you know, I forget my call sign, but you know, blah, 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 3. It's up. It's your call. You can send her or not. And she's now back. I don't know how much time passed, but she's like ready to go. Like she knows how to fight this dude. And she did because she got his ass, but I thought about it. And again, it's like, this is what dogs are for. I had slid down the hill that led to his spider hole once down that mud. And it was a really bad feeling because I'm totally exposed. I didn't get shot. I scampered back up there. And anyways, you can see in the movie, the ISR footage of her. I'm like, this is what it's for. And she wants to go, right? My wife, Laura, always says, the dog will show you what they want. If they're excited about training, it's a good thing. You know, they love to work. That's what they want to do. So she wanted to go. And, you know, I could sense this communal feeling of, what are you going to do? And I said, sir, you know, boss, I'm going to send her again if that's cool. Cause she can get him out. I can tell by she's got an angle here. All right. So I send her and immediately they're like, he's out. Right? This is after a couple hours of doing everything we can. He's out. Bam, bam. My buddy shot the guy. He's floating down the river. We can't find Pepper. And we tried and we tried and we tried and we tried and tried for hours and hours and hours. And he probably drowned her again in that process, but she got him out of the hole. Because we couldn't find her body. She probably went down the Tigris River before him or after him or whatever, but we got him. We killed him. We never found out who it was. It wasn't Zarqawi because he was found later, but mission accomplished. I mean, that's what the dog is for. Somebody would have got shot, you know, a man would have got killed, at least one man getting that guy out. So we looked and looked and looked and I get a call, you know, we found her. We got her. We got her. We see her strobe light. I'm like, oh, we see her strobe light. So they go in. It was just her strobe that had come off. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. Cause that thing was anchored on there. So she was in a fight, a pretty brutal fight, but it's cool. I'm just thinking how she got him out so quickly the second time and the first time, you know, she barely made it. So mission accomplished. But, and then, like I said, I knew I was going to have to decide whether to send her or not. I knew that the boss was going to have to decide when we go home. And you can, you know, right before dawn when it's not getting light yet, but it's almost, you can tell it's about to. I was like, oh man. And so Maddie, I don't show emotion. Back in those days, I don't show emotion. My brother died and I flew out to Seattle and I said, it's not that bad. I don't like nothing. So when the commander called and he had to, like, you can't be there in the daylight. They're going to tear you up. You know, sitting there on the banks of the river, we're just wide open targets. We had to leave and I'm like, sir, we got to find Pepper. And I knew that he knew that, it was a hard call, but it had to be made. And I screamed and I punched the ground. And that's like one of the only times in my life that I've ever really fucking been myself and just let it out. You know, I wish I could be like that all the time. Like a kid, I was like, and just punch the ground, you know, and just, I hate this place. Curse this place. We flew home and I wrote a poem about it called The Empty Kennel. I guess I did have a kennel. I took a kennel out of the little bird and just chucked it as far as I could and went into our house. And I don't remember the next 2 or 3 days. I didn't take drugs. I know I put my ponchos up in my hooch and I just, and my wife, Laura, she was there. She said hi to me or something. And I don't remember. So, that night or that next morning, a pilot, somebody came down and they're like, hey, they think we see Pepper. They think we see her on ISR. They're watching. And I came up and I was like, oh no, that's not her. Thanks. But I could tell it wasn't her. But so many people were affected because of how she, you know, just how she was, and all the pilots knew her. To this day, I'll meet people that are like, you were Pepper's handler? Yeah. So, you know, and then I had that dream for years and years of her running back and forth, like, come on, man, come on. But yeah.
So how long of that rotation have you got to go? And what do they do? Do they supplement, obviously, another dog?
Normally, yes. But there was like 3 weeks left and they had just done a resupply flight. So there wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to come. And at first I stayed, I was like, I'll just go out with, you know, other guys, hardcore. And they're like, no, why don't you go back and knock out this school I had to do anyways for the Army. So I did. I went home. My daughter had just been born. So it was like, you know, I had my sweet little girl to love and help me through the loss of Pepper. And they're definitely connected, you know, in my heart, but, so, and then right after that starts OTC and I, you know, everything was different then. And a lot of it has to do with like the fear of what people think of you, just to, like I said, really get shit out and talk about it openly. You know, throughout my life, because, you know, the stuff I said at the beginning, like I'm thinking about what people are thinking about me all the time. I want to be liked. I want to be admired. And so that's kind of what drives me. But, I don't know. I just want to say that to say it. I mean, I wasn't a strong person. I could just take a lot of pain. I'm becoming a strong person now because, this stuff needs to be talked about. And from everybody, I want to hear stories, man, from people, about stuff like this. So
you finish your OTC, the pistol component. Now you're finally a full operator, within the unit. And what's happening now? You're back to Iraq again? How are you going mentally? Are you noticing anything?
Yep. I'm blank.
Yep.
I'm just a machine. I'm coming into work at 3:34 in the morning and, you know, really getting dope on all my sniper rifles. And I'm just a machine. Nothing phases me. I think that's great at the time. And we go over there and guys are still getting shot. And this is what I talked about on the interview you watched with Hookstead. Mm. Again, the reason I talk about this stuff is to talk about the process. Vietnam guys did it for me. I think it's important. It's not to self-aggrandize. It's not to, you know, tell cool guy stories. It was a long process for me to decide to do this. I was off social media for 10 years and I just came on last year, started my podcast because I really processed it and thought about it and decided that I'm going to talk about it. Because it needs to be talked about.
Exactly.
Why not? Right. So here I am. So, I get in you know, yeah, I'm a full operator. I'm the breacher on the team. And I just, so I get to, you know, set the charge on every door. I get to be the first one in. And, I just start, I realized that we're going after somebody that had been caught twice before. And I was like, you know, and I'd seen guys with daughters get killed. And I'm like, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? So I just, I made the decision to, go to the full extent of the commander's intent within that mission. So if it said kill or capture, I clarified, sir, is that the order you want this done in? Yep. It's a mental decision that I can only speak for me, but I can tell you that not everybody does it. I decided to do it initially because I love my daughter and I didn't want to get shot and killed. Everybody in my team was shot except me because I was small and they're all huge. But so I just got it on, man. And I'm not boasting, but I just was like, okay, sir, you want him dead? And I just rotation after rotation after rotation. We were the team. I mean, we were the team that did it almost every time. You know, at the time it was bragging, you know, sure. It was, it felt good. You're walking around now and people know you, like, yeah, of course that felt good. But looking back, I know I did it for the same reason that I went to the unit, so that I could not be told, it's back to my childhood, man, honestly, so that I could not be told, well, you don't understand something. I had to check every block because I want to know the truth, man. In life, I want to know how the universe was created. Like details. That's what drives me. Not money, not fame, success. I want to know what's real, right? So that's what drives me. That's why I did all that. Like, you know, who's going to do this? Who's going to shoot this? I will. Once I made the decision, after that, it wasn't hard.
Yeah. But these evil men that you were killing are sadistic, evil, yeah, disgusting, vile pieces of shit that needed to be executed, killed.
Yep.
So, and obviously you've got a couple of stories. I know there was one with the house on fire, and rather than take the clean shot, you took a lower shot. Make this prick suffer.
Well, think about this. Bin Laden, he didn't fight, right? He didn't raise a rifle or a pistol at anybody, and they shot his ass. Was that okay?
100%.
Nobody said a thing about that, right? Okay. So how about these other guys that you just mentioned? Because people will make the argument, well, you shot an unarmed man. Well, like Clint Eastwood said, he should have armed himself. Where does, you know, do they have to kill 3,000 people to be eligible for that? Or set an IED and kill 6 Americans? Where's the line? We decide.
Yeah.
We decide. And it's a matter of conscience. It didn't bother me one bit. It still doesn't. I'm proud of it like anything else. Like I am figuring out my pistol. Like it's not a big thing. I just talk about it to get, to bring it up, man. It's, like, God directed me through my life and all that stuff happened to help me find the truth. I am closer to the truth. I know I am. I'm happy. Every year I get happier and better. My life gets better. So that's why I do it. That's why I'm here. But man, yeah, so the fire story, we're going through, it was one of those shred-a-thons where there's like so many buildings. We come in and the little birds had pre-tuned it up. So it's daylight. It's daylight's coming. And I just remember this fat guy laying like with his guts out. He's totally alive, but his intestines are in his hand. Right in the pathway as we're coming up and he's asking for help. And our medic, I remember he stopped and just stapled it to his side or something. And so we're going. The very last structure had concertina wire around it. And somebody said, like, hey, you know, because you can get going so fast that it's too fast. And you're like, okay, let's take a little pause, right? Let's do what we do. Let's do it right. On this last house, we break the corner. I'm behind three guys. And there's a woman. Like, ma'am, you know, blah, 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 the Turks. Turn around. It's in a, somebody in a woman's dress. So, you know, at that time it was like, you know, the worst thing in the world to shoot a woman. And it is, but come on, man. So she turns around and she's a he with an AK and she mows, she shoots the three guys right in front of me. It's a dude. Caleb Tappan, my good buddy, he flanks around and immediately kills the guy. Then we're trying to get into the structure. We're evacuating our wounded. Caleb was one of them, by the way. He was shot in the stomach and still put 14 rounds in the guy. He made sure he told me that after I told the story the first time. He's a sheriff in Montana, now sheriff's deputy. He's like, hey, I'm the one that shot him, not Huggy. So I'm like, okay. No. Caleb, awesome dude. We're getting the wounded back and somebody pokes a hole in the building with a thermobaric law. And it catches on fire. And I hear, and you know, we're trying to evacuate it the whole time. The Terps are talking to the megaphone. Then I hear the kids start to cry and scream, and sort of everybody was in that mode of, not exactly sure what to do. We kind of know, but I don't want to second guess. I could be second guess, but I was like, are we going to go in and get these kids? You know, no, we're not. It's not safe yet for whatever reason. You know, I don't know the reason, but we should go in and rescue these kids. We can do it. Well, we didn't. And it's on fire and eventually they stopped crying. And, you know, that would have been a time where I punched the ground, but I didn't feel at that point. I felt something though, because we're pulling back and God, this is fucking sucks. This whole thing, thinking about it. A guy came out, you know, of that structure and yeah, I saw him and I was like, I was the only one who had a shot. So we're back 200, 300 meters. And yep, I just lowered my EOTech to about here and put it in his gut. And I remember the time of the flight of the round, you know, it was quick, but it was a slow motion thing. Is you know, the time it took for him to do that. And he sat down and I just, you know, I put another one in him and I don't regret stuff like this. I don't.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
Fuck them. That's the sadistic stuff. Sorry. Curse words.
No, man.
That's the sadistic stuff they did, mate, was hide behind women and children. And, you know, it's same thing in Afghanistan. The Taliban did the exact same fucking thing. And then obviously, you know, over the last few years, there's all been all this war crime bullshit that's been popping up from people writing this shit from behind a desk. And not actually being on the ground and witnessing women and children getting burnt alive in a building, or, you know, women used as kids used as human shields. And, you know, there's another story, you know, where you've taken a sniper shot at about 2 meters from a, you know, a guy that's using his wife as a human shield.
I call this my best sniper shot. You know, guys, I got 1600 meters. I'm like, man, you got to hear about this 1.5, 2 meter shot. Cause I'm moving, he's moving, he's pulling his wife on top of him, and it was a small room. He's going like this, and as his wife's coming up, I'm coming up, walking, you know, shooting like the way that's not comfortable. And pop up. And we had that new ammunition, the brown tip, and like just popped him right like an eggshell when you put a pinhole in it. The guy's brain came out right on his wife's lap, and had that combat slow down. My buddy Eric's going down the other wall and he sees this paint brain laying in the lady's lap and she's looking at it. Eric looks at me and we're just like, how did that happen? What are the physics? Like the ballistics. That's so fascinating. We're thinking all this and she's just staring at this brain. She never reacted. Yeah, there's that one, and then go ahead.
No, I'm just, mate. They play silly games and they win silly prizes.
Yeah, yeah. So right, yeah. We have to. What do we have beliefs for if we're not going to stand up for them? Compromise should be the rare thing once a year. We think compromise is a good thing in general. It's not. If we have beliefs, anybody, they should mean something. They should do something and be the reason we discern and make our decisions. You know, and that's where I'm at now in life. This is what I'm talking about. Yes, I'm a Christian, Christology podcast. It's all about who Jesus is. It's not, hey, come be a Christian. Christology means the study of who Jesus is. I can have an atheist on, man. Like, I want to talk about it. I want to answer that question because the claims he makes are pretty substantial. So I think people are answering that one way or another. And that's why I do what I do and why I'm talking about it. So.
Yeah. Mate, so how many rotations in total did you do?
So I did nine like combat
direct
uniformed
yep.
rotation. Action, yeah.
Yep. And then obviously, you know, moving into say the year, you know, 2014, November 2014, you check yourself into the VA. This is where the wheels start to fall off or have fallen off.
Yeah. I'm retired and divorced again. And, my ex-wife made allegations of, well, to prevent my daughter from being at my retirement ceremony, she made allegations to the IG of the Post, whatever. So stuff like that. So I'm being attacked and then I'm having restraining orders, cops coming and take my guns. And I'm in such a bad state. My brother hangs himself. That I said, I don't want the cops to take my guns. I'm not going to let them, you know, I fought for this country. So I, you know, another ex parte restraining order, which is what wives do here when they get mad at their husbands. I said, no, I'm not, shut the door on the cops and like, don't do this. And I was ready for a shootout and death and all that. But I was so blind that, well, my son, my newborn son, I had twin sons. He was 5 months old. He laughed for the first time. I'm holding him saying goodbye. He laughed and it snapped me out of it. And I was like, what am I doing? This is not worth it. Called the cops. You know, it's been 10, 15 minutes. They come back. I said, my weapons are out, locked and cleared. Come and get him. Come get me. We're not doing this. I'm going to live. All that happened. You know, and then still that night in November, 14, it's dread came on me. I mean, it was just bad, evil. I don't know what, but it was like, you're going to die tonight. And my brother had killed himself. You know, I felt like I was going to die somehow that night. So I did the only thing crazier than that I could think of, check myself into the VA. I go there at 3 a.m. and, I just wanted to disappear. Like I wanted to be in there for 3 months at least. And I got put in the mental ward and, you know, and the door clangs behind you, like you're locked in there. And they put me in a room with a dude who rolls over and he's got one arm and a torso in his head. He's missing both legs and one arm. And the look in his eyes was death, like way more than I was ready for. And right then I was like, okay, I want to get out of here. Took about 3 days for me to talk my way out, but I did. And then, you know, God put Laura in my path. We'd been friends, but, yeah, I was divorced again. That's where she and I really got together. And that was, I went to the VA. I got a great doctor. I got help and I got better and better and better from then on. So it's possible.
Yeah. So what I want to break down, mate, is what helped you? What helped you to get better? You know, this is, you know, again, we're putting this podcast out to many police officers, many first responders, many military guys had probably gone through this, what you went through, mate. So I want to figure out, you know, for you, obviously every person is different, but what helped you mend?
It's a really good question. What it was somebody listening and giving a shit. It's really what it comes down to. And her name was Dr. Sarah Boding. And we told that story over and over and over. And it was a method that she used, and of Pepper and Lance. And we told it over and over and over. And she would say, stop, go back. What are you feeling there at this point? And, you know, I'm getting angry. Like, what? Why are you asking me this? But I trusted the process. And right towards the end of that was when HBO shows up out of nowhere. Hey, we heard about Pepper. Would you be interested in doing a documentary? Maybe. They talked to us for a while. They earned our respect, me and Laura. You know, we knew Channing Tatum was going to do it right and not just, you know, embarrass us. And they did do it right. So we're there, you know, I call it suicide to red carpet. From 14 to 17, I went from ready to commit suicide to walk in the red carpet in Hollywood. And it was just ridiculous, like so many other things we've talked about. It was ridiculous. I'm laughing. There's pictures of me laughing because I'm like, why am I here?
Yeah.
But it was cool too, to see Channing Tatum sitting right behind me with Jenna Dewan, his wife at the time, and some, you know, watching this on the screen, man. It was surreal. Talked to him after that. And then the guys from the TV show SEAL Team were there. I met them. They're like, you want to come out and watch this film? And so I did, and I didn't want to, but I did. And that's where something really cool happened. Like, the director of that show at the time, Chris Chulek, had me watch a scene. He had me sit in his chair and watch this filming scene. And there's a scene where they shoot an RPG at, this is season one, just up, you know, like props. But it flashed some memory in me that, like, I was like, oh shit. And Laura was there with me, and I had done all this work at the VA. So it hit me in a spot where we don't like to go. Right. And I was like, I got to leave, Laura, we got to leave. And I knew from my work with Sarah Boding, I was like, stay in it, get through it. I did. And I shed tears in front of this guy. And I said, that was very well done. It looked extremely real, a little too real. And he was like, wow. And then I just started having these interactions with people. I've never been good at the whole social thing, but I'm meeting people, and they care. They're listening. I had more progress in my heart in Hollywood than at the VA.
Yep.
Totally unexpected, because they cared. They really cared. You know, and it's a tough situation. People, you know, thanks for your service. Like, what else are you going to say? I mean, that's, thank you for saying that. I don't not appreciate that. I'm not, that doesn't offend me. Hey, thanks. It's hard. It's not an easy fix.
Yeah, mate, it's good to hear that doctor, you know, in as well, you know, 2014, 2007, anything even up until now is still a work in progress with PTSD. They still don't understand it. They're still figuring it out, and it's a never-ending circle, you know, cycle, I should say, right now. You know, obviously, soldiers, as you said, the 22 is the US statistics. You know, not too many here in Australia, generally about one a week here in Australia, which is still a fair few, and still figuring it all out. So it's good to hear that something did work with you to get you, snap you out of that. And was it like an exposure, like you spoke about, say, exposure therapy? So it's talking about the same story over and over again and manipulating the mind.
Yep. Yeah. And I did not like it. I drove there once a week, an hour and a half each way to do it. I just trusted the process. I trusted Laura, my wife. We've been together 10 years now. It, you know, never dreamed that life could be good. I thought people were faking it when I see people happy. in life and stuff. Like, they're faking it. I'm starting to get there, man. And it's worth it. It's all worth it. And that's what I want to say through all this shit.
And what were you doing outside of the therapy? Did you have any hobbies, or were you just keep your mind active, get back into fitness?
I was going to court a lot because I was my second divorce.
Yep.
I was in court just constantly. So it was that. And I worked for a nonprofit called Elder Heart, Mission 22. Some friends of mine, they like built sculptures and stuff in towns to get the community talking about it. I did that during those years, you know, not making money. I had enough money from retirement to live. When more money comes, cool. Like sometimes it did. My wife, Laura, and I bought a catamaran, lived on that for a while. Cool. But, it's about just seeking answers to what's driving me. So that was those years. After that, then I went to seminary. I just always wanted to not be a preacher. Everybody said, you're going to be a, nope. Mm-mm. But I love stuff in the Bible. Like, God did this to teach the men of Israel war who hadn't experienced war yet. There's verses like that, or tattooed on my arm, the Lord is a man of war. I got that in Israel. And some chick at the tattoo shop's like, what is that? Because they're so liberal over there. And I said, your man wrote it, Moses. Check it out. Exodus 15:3. She's all pissed off and stuff, but war is a real thing, man, right?
Exactly right, mate. And as you just said, you know, Israel, they're going through that right now.
Yeah. I don't even understand the argument of who does not have a right to defend themselves. Like, animals have that right. I don't even get it, man.
No, mate. It's a whole separate podcast and right. Go for hours, because it's just absolutely wild. And hopefully the Israelis can kill every single Hamas, whatever you want to call them, fuckwits, cockheads. Hopefully they kill every single one of them slowly. Gut shots as well. Hopefully gut shots.
There's a quote from Netanyahu's brother who was killed in Entebbe in 76. He said, what can you do with... I have Arab friends. I do. I had one on the show, Amir Tadros. Mm. This is not... But he said, what can you do with the Arab people? You can't kill them all. Thus, you have the sadness, the endless sadness of young men destined for endless war. I read that quote back in the arm. I'm like, shit. It's pretty real.
It is. It is, mate. It's, mate, again, that's a whole separate podcast. But, mate, mate, incredible. What a life story. It's, you've gone from obviously hardships growing up through to, you know, joining the military, and then not only just joining the military, joining, you know, one of the most elite units in the world, Delta Force, aka CAG, SMU, Special Missions Unit, etc., and taking it to the next level. However, during that time, as we know, it's not a normal life within military, especially if you've deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, or, you know, any hostile environment. It's something you'll never forget. It's ingrained into your life, and obviously changed your life, where, you know, your brother took his own life and then you were close. You were within minutes of doing the exact same thing. However, you fought through it, and 180, and here you are, smiling, happy.
A big, long, slow 180, like a train on tracks, right? It takes a long time, but
you know, you're proof, one of the living proofs that it can do that 180, and you can get out of that hole that you're in, regardless of what happens, because everyone goes through a lot of shit, and there are people that'll listen, like Dr. Sarah, and...
Yeah.
Help you along the way, you know. So shout out to her, obviously, if she's out there listening somewhere.
And so to put this in context, I was talking to a friend's wife the other day. She's a nurse. She's talking about, I said, how's your day? She said, good. Why? You look tired. She said, because yesterday I was doing chest compressions on a newborn with her, you know, for half an hour to keep this baby alive. And it's like, it hit me that that is heavier than all the shit I've been through, right? There's people doing stuff like that every day. And so she started talking about it. She needed to talk about it, you know? It's just like we get into this zone, oh, that's soft and, you know, mushy. Like, it doesn't fucking matter when people are dying. We got to do something. I'm tired of people dying, you know? Let's at least give it a shot. I used to call it the Australia plan. I'd never been to Australia, but I told myself, I may kill myself, but if worse comes to worse, I'm going to just go to Australia first. I don't know why, but it was like, I'm going to do that first.
Yeah.
And that probably kept me alive because, you know, I didn't go. I was just going to go be on a beach and be a bum. Like, might as well do that before I off myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Mate, you know, yeah, people dying too soon. And that, you know, that's the reason why I like to share stories like yours, mate. I know you lived that hard life, and it just shows people that people go through different things. However, there's a way through it. So just stick with it. Mate, just to tie off the podcast, a couple of final questions. And I guess we kind of just spoke about this first question. But the first question is, you know, what advice can you give to people just to keep on keeping on, complete any goal they set their mind to, and just to crush it in life and take control?
Yeah, I think they need, I would say identify it. That's the hardest thing. I want to crush it. What's it? Well, it's not necessarily money or career or this. It's satisfaction, maybe. Okay, so figure out what it is first. That's, I think, 75% of the difficulty. Figure out what it is. Really figure it out. And if you're wrong, reset. But once you know what it is, go at it. Take a risk. Say fuck. I mean, be the first in line in a shooting drill. Don't be afraid to be embarrassed. Face your tank. We had an M1 tank. I knocked on the door because, you know, everybody's like, what? Like, take a risk. And that's what I would say. Identify it. And then if you're not crushing it, take a damn risk.
Give it a crack. Give it a go.
Yep. Talk to somebody about, you know, stuff that you don't want to talk about, your childhood, you know. You Aussies are awesome for bringing that up first.
No, it's part of your life, you know, and that's, I think, especially, again, going back to who we are, military first responder, a lot of us are shaped off how we grew up, where we grew up. And, you know, it's crazy how similar all our lives were as kids growing up in rough environments and then becoming what we do in the future. You know, it's incredible. You know, I'm sure there's studies out there somewhere, or someone needs to study it because it's incredible. Mate, a second question, what is the plans for the future? Now you're a podcast host.
Yeah, and it's I'm not going to say horrible. You know, we've got 17 subscribers and like, it's okay. I don't have to. I'm crushing it because I'm taking that risk and doing it. If it happens that we get a lot of people, that's fine. I don't define success. And I just asked my 11-year-old twin boys, what is success? Well, money. The success to me is the progressive realization of God's will for me in my life. Knowing what to do. You know, no one's half the battle, and then no one win is the harder part. So to keep taking risks, and I know when I'm doing it because I'm uncomfortable. Like, as I'm talking to you here about this stuff, I'm sitting here peeling tape off. I'm in that, and it's okay. Like, that's what I do. You know, my hands start moving. I got to do something because I'm uncomfortable. So I owe it to myself and my kids to put myself in that position to learn something, to figure out why PTSD and TBI together make people nuts. Whatever I can do. If that's talking about uncomfortable stuff and maybe taking some flack for it. All right. So, plans for the future are, I can't, do nothing. I'm not a busybody. I like to do nothing, but God doesn't let me. He's faith has to move. I believe faith has to move. So, you know, I do all these things at church. I have a mission in Sierra Leone. Every Wednesday we do a Bible study, and then Sunday I talk with them. Never expected that. That came out of nowhere. It's weird for me. Like, you really want a white dude to talk about theology in your church? Okay, but I'm so proud. I mean, there's 12-year-olds in bare feet listening to me talk about theology. To me, like, that's freaking, I won the day, man, when I do something like that. So, yeah, more of that.
Just in regard to the religious side, now, have you always been religious, or was there that defining moment where obviously you've almost seen death, which you almost did? Did that wake you up in a way, or was it, yeah?
It was all that, but I wasn't always religious. We never went to church as a family. Maybe a couple of times Easter, Christmas, you know, but there was nothing. I just always felt this like, guidance, and, it's comforting. Like, I always have known that I have a creator. And so I've just always seeking in ways, to find that, to run that down. I stir up trouble in my church, man. Like, people love me, but they may not like me at first because I challenge things, you know? What does it mean, Jesus loved, or God so loved the world that he gave his own? What does that really mean? Because honestly, to me, that didn't mean anything for decades. You see it everywhere. You hear it. I need to figure out what that means. Do the work, you know, for me. So that's my challenge. Run it to ground.
Yeah. Mate, third question. Now, this one is completely out of anything. Now, give us a guilty obsession or a, you know, something that people don't know about you. What are you doing? Like, when you're on your own, what are you doing? Watching sad movies, or are you a chocolate fiend? You got chocolate under your bed?
So, man, I'm such a freaking softy. We watch my son calls it gay sewing. It's Project Runway. Or my wife had it on. There's another one, a better one, with Heidi Klum. I forget it, but it's clothing designers from all around the world. And, you know, and I'm like, what? Are you going to watch this? Well, I get sucked into this thing, and they start cutting people at the end. And Laura looks, she's like, are you crying? I'm like, yes. Like, I don't want anybody to get cut. And it's like, I just let it happen because of the hilarity of it, you know, because I looked at my brother dead and felt nothing. And now I'm crying during Project Runway. Like, cool. I'm alive again.
Yeah.
You know, laugh at me. I don't care. It's cool. I'm laughing at myself.
Are you, is that something for the future? Maybe a fashion designer.
No, gosh, what do I really want to do? I like this, man. Like, I don't necessarily think I'm good at it or meant for it. And I don't like the tech part, but I like context. I like the stories. I would love to talk to you and hear your story and Tom Brown's. And
yeah,
I just like the process. It's so cool to me. This is where research and development is happening.
Yeah, mate. You know, I love it as well. Honestly, to share stories like yours, and, you know, obviously once I put this podcast out, the messages that, you know, people will resonate with your story, that, you know, not everyone will. Some people, I'm sure I've got listeners that'll probably hate you, but that's the world we live in. You know, yeah. We've all got people that are with us or against us, but that's what life is. But it's just good to share stories, and
yeah,
you know, that's the way it is. Now, mates, fourth question, favorite movie or TV show? I guess your TV show is Project Runway.
No. What about a movie? So I heard this on one of your podcasts, so I thought about it. Space Odyssey 2001.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Man, that's freaky. I love like the art of the possible.
Yeah.
You know, just like freaking outside Jupiter. And then like, I like thinking about death and what's going to happen. Where, you know, do we really have a soul? animals, you know, there's scripture that says that animals have souls. Like, that's cool to me. I've helped people when their dog dies by showing them the scripture. Like, hey, look, Ecclesiastes 3:21 says the soul of an, the spirit of an animal may rise up with God. To me, that's cool stuff. So yeah, Space Odyssey 2001, Platoon, you know, that's in there. And I thought about songs too, because you, I heard that too on a podcast.
Yeah, the, yeah, next question. So yeah, your favorite artist.
I really like Rush. I'm not like a Rush type person fully. I'm not a fiend, but there's a song called Xanadu and it's kind of gay, but I really love, it's like a 16 minute song. And I just love it. And I play it. My kid, my boys love it. So going to football practice, we play that every time. It's called the football song.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Lucky you didn't say Xanadu first, mate, because that could have been Olivia Newton-John.
But hey, man, oh, that's funny. I, is that the song? Magic. You know the song?
Yeah.
Magic?
Yeah.
I listened to that training for OTC and, you know, laugh at me. I don't care. Yes, I got all the metal stuff too. Man, we had this. I'm sorry. I gotta put this in. We were going out one night on a, just a kill fest, you know, and so we're just getting it on. And our medic, I walk by, I hear this song, Spandau Ballet. You know that song?
Yep. Yep.
You know this.
Yeah.
And normally it's metal. It's hard stuff. I'm like, what are you listening to? And he's just like, man, this gets me going. And like, so that's become a thing now, like a memory where that's our go to war song, Spandau Ballet. Gotta laugh at ourselves, man.
No, exactly, mate. Exactly, mate. Just quickly, you know, you spoke about, you know, souls and, you know, what do you think Pepper's doing right now? Just biting bad dudes in the dick somewhere?
Yeah. yeah. If she wants that, yeah. But man, she's gonna be. I do believe. Check out Ecclesiastes 3, chapter 3, verse 21. I do believe that she's gonna show up. She has, man, this dog, a lot of people have something with dogs, but when she turned back and looked at me, I talked about it, you know, in the interviews and movie, she turned back and looked at me. I'm looking through night vision before she went the last time. She held this glance for just much longer than she normally would have, 2 or 3 seconds. If she looked back, it would have been like that. But she turned and looked back, looked at me in the eye before she committed that last time and then went. It's like, I mean, I was just like, did anybody see that? It was incredible. So, but you can't really go there with a lot of people. They just like, eh, and I understand it. You know, I'm not mad, at the politics and all the silly shit. It's silly, but you know, they're working it out too. They're trying to work it out. So work it out. Find out you're wrong.
Yeah. Mate, well, she's a war hero. That's for sure.
She is. She's got a monument. My wife, Laura, built or helped put up the Soft Canine Memorial. She wrote a children's book called How I Became a Canine Commando. She wrote it from the point of view of Pepper. It's a children's book. It's on Amazon. It's really cool. Every time I read it, I cry, man. So,
yeah. My dogs, dogs are amazing, especially, you know, within that military theater. You know, the lives, you know, you sent Pepper down there to, you know, pretty much preserve the life of a human, of one of your guys, you know, and that's what dogs do. You know, at the end of the day, they were a tool and, you know, they saved countless coalition lives, you know, friends, you know, explosive detection dogs. Imagine how many lives they've saved. It's just astronomical.
Yeah. This is random, but I thought of you. When I heard some of your story, the Jason Kelsey retirement, people are watching that and talking about, having my son watch it. And somebody in my family, like, said, what's he crying for? He's got millions of dollars. And I thought about it and I was like, they're like, he should just shut up. I said, no, think about it. He's living life. He's going away from his brothers, right? He is feeling it real time. That's how it should be. You know, that's living life there.
That's exactly. And it's funny you talk about that because, you know, there's a lot of psychologists out there. They obviously, with us military, police, etc. It's losing the identity. Same thing for sports stars. They're in a sport for so long. They're involved. That's all they do. He's, you know, those guys, anyone, they just play football. That's what they do day in, day out, like we did. Military, day in, day out. It's the same, similar, I would say same, but obviously similar mindset of living that life and losing your identity once you leave that that occupation, which is, you know, where people struggle. And that's where that emotion comes from.
Yeah, and you have an interesting situation. It's a weird time to get out.
Yeah.
Was it?
It was. It's something, you know, if I look back now, I regret getting out. Mm. But I was so young that you don't make correct decisions. I got out. You know, it's crazy how the world works, though, because would I be where I am now if I did get out at that time? Or would I still be in the military and never start a podcast, never worked overseas with all these people? You know what I mean? Like, so it's that's the way the world works.
Yeah.
I lived some trauma over the first few years of leaving the defense. There was a lot of trauma. Again, losing the identity, leaving mates and friendships that, you know, you spend every second with these guys. You know exactly. Yeah. You're pushing their hemorrhoids back up their bums. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know exactly what it's like. So it was a lot of trauma. But again, mate, who knows where I'd be if I stayed in.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like the right thing happened, you know.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. But, that's life, mate. That's life. Mate, for whatever reason, people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you?
Instagram, Christology Podcast, and YouTube, Christology Podcast, is where we put the videos up. Yep. And I'm just, you know, I've been back on social media for like a year, so I'm pretty rusty, but I'm getting there.
No, awesome, mate. Awesome. Yeah, so for the listeners, definitely get over there and give Dave a follow and listen in on what he's got to say. Mate, again, really appreciate you coming on, giving your time, sharing your story. I know it's not an easy thing to do. You know, it's still, still a fresh thing, losing Pepper and losing all your friends, especially within the unit and in the Rangers side of things. War is, it's a bad place, but, you know, we spoke about it can be a good place and it's a comfortable place for people like us.
Yeah. Maddie, thank you so much. Like, when I get done with, I know I'm going to go crash and sleep well. Thank you for this, for what you do. I barely know you, but I can just hear it and feel it, that you're real and you're coming from the heart, and that's how life should be. So thank you so much, Maddie.
Appreciate it, mate. Appreciate it. And we'll stay in contact for sure.
Okay, brother.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Wait. Now, quickly, just before you go, I want to tell you about 3-0's coffee. Now, as you know, I like my coffee how I like my men, long and black. However, lately, I've moved into the cold brews. I'm loving it, obviously, because the weather here in Australia at the moment is quite hot. So what I've been doing is using the seasoned Campaigner pour over filter bags, literally rip open the packet, put the filter bag over my coffee mug, a few ice cubes, pour in some hot water, let it cool down, add a sugar or two just to make it sweet, and I fucking love them. Honestly, you get the kick that you need out of the caffeine and the taste is great. So if you want to get yourself a supply of coffee, head over to 30scoffee.com.au. From there, you can choose whatever you want. You've got the beans, you got the pour over filter bags, got some merchandise. And just to let you know that a percentage of their sales is forwarded to organizations that support first responders. So while you're getting your coffee, you're doing a good deed by getting some of this money to the first responders and where it needs to go. While you're there, don't forget to use the discount code 3ZLimits. Now look in our bio, you see that discount code, use it. Get your discounts. So again, jump onto 30scoffee.com.au and grab yourself a supply.